A pleasure to welcome back Rabbi Mintz and the founding of Maimonides, one of the first day schools, of course, founded by Rabbi Soloveitchik. And for the rest of the story, here's Rabbi Mintz.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Shavua Tov, everybody. It's nice to be back. This is the second of my three-part series this round, which is really kind of snapshots of American, the history of American Judaism, maybe specifically American Orthodoxy. Today, I want to talk about the founding of the Maimonides School in Boston. And obviously, Maimonides is not the only Jewish day school that was founded in the 1930s, and we'll use it as an example for what Jewish education, what Jewish life looked like in the 1930s in the United States. I want to give credit to my friend, Rabbi Seth Farber, who has gone on to do great things. Rabbi Seth Farber wrote, as his doctoral dissertation, a book called An American Orthodox Dreamer. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik in Boston's Maimonides School, which is available and which is a wonderful book. And the book is great. It's worth it just for the picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik on the cover. So here's the book put out by Brandeis, Seth Farber. You can find it on Amazon. When we talk about the Jewish community in the 1930s in America, we really have to start with what was going on in the United States specifically during that period. Between 1881 and 1924, 2.5 million Jews immigrated to the United States. Most of them came from Russia. And it's important to know that most of them came from traditional, or what we would call Orthodox families. That doesn't mean that when they got here, they remained Orthodox, but they came originally from Orthodox families. Because the point of entry was generally New York, was generally Ellis Island, so most of the Jews stayed on the Lower East Side. And then even from the Lower East Side, many of them, if not most of them, stayed, you know, on the East Coast. Again, that doesn't mean that there weren't important communities other places, but most of them stayed on the East Coast. In 1900, there were 40,000 Jews in Boston. By 1914, by World War I, there were already 80,000 Jews in Boston. You have 80,000 Jews, you have to talk about what Jewish education looked like in Boston. And basically, Jewish education pre-1917 was really a collection of second-rate chadarim in the sense of after-school programs, taught by immigrants who more or less were people who, you know, didn't have jobs or wanted to supplement their education. There clearly was a need to upgrade the Jewish education in Boston during that period. And therefore, in 1917, the Jewish community invited someone by the name of Louis Horowitz. Louis Horowitz was interesting. He had been a student in Volozhin. But when he came to the United States, he became very active and interested in Jewish education. And he was invited to Boston to assess the quality of Jewish secondary schools, but your after schools in Boston. He basically founded the Board of Jewish Education in Boston. Now, in 1917, there were 3,000 students in Sunday schools and in chadarim in Boston. Within 10 years, the number of students in these chadarim quadrupled, and there were over 15,000 students. Now, what was his theory, this Horowitz? First of all, he understood that you had to elevate the quality. Elevating the quality meant to hire teachers who took it more seriously, and generally to make sure that the students took it more seriously. But it was much more important than that. You see, he had a very what we would call today Zionist, pro-Hebrew, kind of secular Zionist view towards Jewish education. What does that mean? What that meant was that he believed that all of these students who spent all day in public school and then went to the Hebrew school after school, they needed to learn Hebrew language. They needed to learn about Zionism. And remember, Zionism in 1917, this was really the beginning of political Zionism as we knew it. And he taught traditional texts. He taught the Chumash. He taught the Siddur. But here's the key point about this guy, Horowitz. He believed that there was no connection between the study that these kids were doing in these supplementary schools and practice. He was absolutely not interested in whether these people were religious in any way. He thought they needed an education. And in a way, and this is going to become the major topic for the whole discussion today, in a way, he thought that the Jewish secondary schools would be like public schools. What do I mean? In public school, you get an education. What you do with your education is up to you. The public school doesn't teach you math and tell you, therefore, you need to be a mathematician. It doesn't teach you social studies and tell you, therefore, you have to be a political scientist. It teaches you, and you decide to do whatever you want to do with it. He felt the same way about these Hebrew secondary schools. He wanted to give the students a first-rate education, as first-rate as could be after school, but he didn't want to tell people how they were supposed to act. And basically, he was very successful. Again, 15,000 students, and it had grown from 3,000 students. He clearly was very, very successful. And people were happy with the schools. And this, again, will be important. It fit into their attitude towards America. Their children went to public school during the day. A couple of times a week, they went to Hebrew secondary school. They learned Hebrew. They learned text. They learned Zionism. But they weren't being told how to behave. They weren't being told how orthodox or how traditional they needed to be. But then into the picture comes the one and only Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in 1903 in White Russia in Khaslovich. He went eventually to Berlin, where he got his PhD, was married, and had his first daughter. And then he came to New York in 1932. The first thing to know about Rabbi Soloveitchik and Boston is that he did not intend to go to Boston. Actually, he came to America with the intention of getting a job in Chicago at the Hebrew Theological Seminary in Chicago. But 1932, that was not such a good year in the United States. That was during the Depression. They had no money. He landed in New York, but they told him, "I'm sorry, there's no job." This is Rabbi Soloveitchik. Can you imagine turning away Rabbi Soloveitchik, telling him he's 29 years old in 1932, telling him, "I'm sorry, Rabbi Soloveitchik, there's no job." And literally, he lived in New York with his wife and with his daughter, and he had no job. With the assistance of his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who then was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik was appointed as the head of the Vad Ha'ir, of the Rabbinic Council of Boston. And his job, you know, it's funny you say, in those days, you know, he was the Vad Ha'ir, meaning they established the job for him. So what was his role supposed to be? What he was supposed to be was he was supposed to unify the Jewish community of Boston. And that meant for him that he needed to focus on the Jewish education. And again, the Jewish education, at least in the initial years, meant specifically the quality of these chadarim, of these secondary schools, of these afternoon schools. And how did he make a change in these schools? There was a YU. Yes, there was a YU. In 1927, Yeshiva College moved to Washington Heights. It was not a university until under Dr. Belkin in the 40s, but there was a Yeshiva College, absolutely. And Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva College in 1932. Rabbi Soloveitchik writes as follows about his approach to education in these schools. In addition to a fundamental knowledge of reading, writing, and spelling of Hebrew, and familiarity with prayers, the new program emphasizes the following cardinal points. Number one, the Torah to be studied in the original, unabridged form, and to be interpreted in the spirit of the tradition and according to the commentary of Rashi. So here's number one before we go any further. It's not enough just to learn Chumash. You need to learn Chumash and Rashi. Number two, the meaning of the prayers should be made clear and intelligible to the children. You had to learn davening, okay? Number three, Jewish history should be made familiar to the child in such a way that the great personalities of the past should captivate their affections. So learn Jewish history to give the children a feeling as if they were continuing in the traditions of the past. And number four, Mishnah, Gemara, and Pirkei Avos should be made an integral part of the course of study. Now that also is interesting. These kids, right, I guess after Bar Mitzvah, they already started learning Mishnah, Gemara, and specifically Pirkei Avos. Now, this approach to the secondary schools was very much different than the original approach. And you hear it from the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik describes what was taught. Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't just care about what they studied. Rabbi Soloveitchik was trying to create a generation of young Orthodox, Shomrei Mitzvos, young people in Boston. This was a very, very different approach. And Rabbi Soloveitchik had a lot of, and we're going to talk about this, there was a lot of pushback to Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach to Hebrew school in Boston. You see, again, these immigrants who came to the United States, they left Russia. They came to the democracy of the United States. They didn't want anybody to tell them or their children what to do. Their children went to public school. Their children went to Hebrew school. They didn't want a Rabbi Soloveitchik telling them, and you need to keep Shabbos, and you need to keep Yontif, and you need to daven. It wasn't anti-Jewish. It was considered to be anti-American. That wasn't what it meant to be an American. To be an American meant that you were allowed to do what you wanted to do. And that is an extremely important point about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And Rabbi Soloveitchik really came from a different world than most of these people who immigrated to the United States during that period. Now, ultimately, attendance dwindled, and there became a financial problem. And most of these secondary schools ended up closing down. Now, so here you have it. Boston, in the middle of the 1930s, you have Rabbi Soloveitchik in the community. You have a few Hebrew schools. You have 100,000 Jews in Boston. You have most of the people who are happy with the Hebrew schools as they are, not telling anybody how to behave and what to do. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, who is not satisfied with the situation. To understand Rabbi Soloveitchik's next move, or what we would call today in the 21st century, Rabbi Soloveitchik's pivot. Could you compare the situation in Boston 1 second? So first of all, Ethan says, my grandfather was a member of the Vod Ha'ir in Boston who called for the end of the discussion to have a vote on the bringing of the Rav to Boston. That's great. Could you compare the situation in Boston versus New York? We'll get there in a minute, okay? We'll get to New York in a minute. So to understand Rabbi Soloveitchik's move or Rabbi Soloveitchik's pivot, You have to understand the situation of the Orthodox Jewish community in the 1930s and early 1940s. Between 1935 and 1946, more than a dozen Jewish day schools opened in the United States. Just think about that. 1935 to 1946, more than a dozen Jewish day schools opened in America. Ramaz and Flatbush are just two examples. Now, what led to that? So you have to understand two things that were very, very different. Number one, there was an upheaval in Europe, right? The 1930s were, and then of course the 1940s, were a very difficult period for the Jews of Europe. We know that. You don't need me to tell you that. But what you do need me to tell you is that I have to explain to you something. There's a lot that has been written about exactly what American Jews knew about the situation in Germany under Hitler in the 40s, and the Holocaust in the 40s. When did American Jews know what they knew? But I want to tell you something, and this is an important thing. What American Jews knew from the very beginning was that there was an upheaval in Europe, that the situation of the Jews in Europe was not a good one. Now, what that did was, in a sense, that put more pressure on American Judaism, specifically American Orthodoxy. There was a feeling, even though most people couldn't articulate it, there was a feeling as if the future of Jewry may not be in Europe anymore, may move from Europe to the United States. That's an extremely interesting kind of psychological pivot, which led people to, you know, to realize that, hey, we need to make a move in America. We are the center of Judaism. That's number one. Number two, which is completely unrelated to this, is that the 1930s is really the first generation when American-born Jews outnumbered European-born Jews. That means that Jews who were born in America, there were more of them than Jews who immigrated and were born in Europe. So for the first time, there was really a feeling, a need for an education, for a culture, for a society that was going to address the needs of the American Orthodox, the American Jew, not the immigrant European who happened to be living here. Now, both of those things led in 1937, Rabbi Soloveitchik to found the Maimonides School in Roxbury, in a community of Boston. Again, the realization that the center of Judaism was moving here to the United States, and the fact that they realized that this was a generation of American-born Jews, they needed to create a school. Other schools had begun or were beginning, and Rabbi Soloveitchik opened a full-day school. Dr. Meiselman, Harry Meiselman, who was Rabbi Soloveitchik's brother-in-law, describes the school in the following way. For years, our highest ideals were crumbling away. Our religious education amounted to a bar mitzvah speech, a party, and then what? The boy forgot whatever he learned and grew perfectly indifferent to the call of the Orthodox synagogue and other religious institutions. These existing conditions were quite unbearable to me and became more so after I had a child of my own. It has always been my worry that when my child grows up, there would be no place in this community to provide her with a thorough Jewish education, such as many of my friends in New York, and that was the question about New York, are offering their children. The founders of Maimonides School were not satisfied to view complacently Jewish youth drifting away from religious observance right after the bar mitzvah ceremony. They felt that the spiritual content of Jewish education should be so emphasized that it would become an integral part of the individual and would remain with him permanently. Now, this little paragraph written by Rabbi Soloveitchik's brother-in-law is a very important paragraph. Because what you see is, you see the crisis, but you see the way that that Rabbi Soloveitchik's brother-in-law, that Meiselman, describes the crisis. The crisis is not a crisis of education. The crisis is really a crisis of observance. The crisis is a crisis of creating young Jewish, you know, kids, then teenagers, then adults. And how are they going to do that? And Rabbi Soloveitchik realized that the only way that they were going to be able to create a new generation of American Orthodox was by building a school, was by building Maimonides. Now, this is also something that's important. You know, you build a day school. A Jewish day school, and this actually also going back to the question of New York, this was actually a question in Ramaz when Rabbi Joseph Lookstein founded Ramaz. You know, the Jews who came to this country, they sent their kids to public school. Now, the reason they sent their kids to public school was basically because public school was free. They didn't have a lot of money, and public school was free. But public school also represented an American ideal. We're coming to this country. We're immigrants. We want to be Americans. We're going to send our children to public school. The creation of Jewish day schools took the Jews out of these public schools and brought them back into, in a sense, into the ghetto, into these Jewish schools. This was an extremely controversial move to create these Jewish day schools. And Rabbi Soloveitchik had to deal with this criticism that, in a sense, by creating Maimonides, by creating a Jewish day school, what he was doing was he was being anti-American. And Rabbi Soloveitchik writes the following. This is the first time in the history of the Jewish community in Boston that such a school was established. The purpose of this institution is to provide Jewish children with an excellent secular education combined with a traditional Jewish training. The training is not limited to theoretical knowledge alone, but coordinates it with the religious mode of living. That is religious attitudes and the practical observance of our commandments and laws. But notice what he says first. He says the purpose of this institution is to provide Jewish children with an excellent secular education. That came before the Jewish education. It's true that it provided an excellent education and it taught them to be religious. But he says first that it provided an excellent secular education. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik's response to all the people who were critical of him and said, you cannot create a Jewish day school. That's un-American. But Rabbi Soloveitchik says, no, that is not un-American. A Jewish day school is not un-American. I am going to provide a secular education that's as good as the secular education that they're getting, you know, from any of the public schools. Now, whether or not that's true, so that we'll talk about in a minute. But the idea, again, you know, a lot of these things, the reality and how it worked out, it might have taken, you know, 50 years for Maimonides to become a top, you know, a top rate, a top notch school. But when you talk about the founding, you have to talk about what his ideals were, what his, you know, what his dream was. And clearly Rabbi Soloveitchik's dream was not to create a cheder, was not to go back to Brisk and to create the yeshiva of Lithuania and Eastern Europe. He wanted to create an American Jewish day school that was right for the community in America. Now, what did Maimonides look like when it was founded in 1937? So, of course, what you want to know is, how much did it cost? Well, I'll tell you that it cost $400 a year to go to Maimonides in 1937. Now, $400 a year was you know, not a lot of money, but it was money. Because I want to explain to you something. You have to understand that. Public school is free, right? I see Rabbi Silverberg looking carefully, right? Public school is free. So $400 a year is $400 that they didn't have to spend if they sent their kids to public school. This is a, you know, this was a serious commitment on their part. Now, who was the faculty? So the secular faculty was teachers from the public school that taught in the public school in the morning and then taught in the yeshiva in the afternoon. Oh, that's funny. I didn't know that. They taught in the public school in the morning, and they came to Maimonides in the afternoon. The truth of the matter is that that's the way it worked in the schools in New York as well. Even in Ramaz, they would take the teachers from the fancy private schools in the Upper East Side, and they would come to Ramaz in the afternoon to teach the classes. The Jewish to about $7,000 in 2020. $7,000. I think most of us would be happy if our day school if our day school tuition was only $7,000. So it's a complicated thing. You say that's a lot of money, but it's not a lot of money. It's very hard. It has a lot to do with, you know, how they view the value of education. Sorry, I just missed that last comment, which I'm going to go to now. My father's tuition with St. John's University in 1941 was $126. Okay, this was more expensive than St. John's University. Who were the Rebbes? So you see here, and we're going to come back to this in a little while, Rabbi Soloveitchik probably did not have the quality of Jewish teachers that he would have liked. Most of the Jewish teachers in the school in this generation were people who were people who had come from Europe, educated in Europe. Many of them did not speak English all that well. The idea of having an American educated Jewish teacher was not something that happened in these early years. And as we're going to see, that was something that might have created a little bit of tension for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Now, where did these classes take place? These classes took place in the Young Israel of Roxbury. Roxbury is where the Jewish community was before the Jewish community in the 60s, really, moved in Boston to moved to Brookline. The Jewish community, I can wait to the end, stay questions. The Jewish community was in Roxbury. I'll just tell you that Seth Farber in his book tells a kind of sweet story. He says that when the heat was broken in the Young Israel of Roxbury, where do you think people went? Obviously, they went to the Soloveitchik living room, and they all cuddled up on the sofa in the Soloveitchik living room, and they held their classes there. Now, it gives you a feel, a very much, the term I like to use is, very much of a Hamish kind of, a Hamish kind of school. And that's very much what it was. And you're not surprised. There weren't very many students. The number of students fluctuated, but there were, you know, they were in the teens, 20s, 30s numbers of students. There weren't all that many students in Maimonides. And it was very much of a Hamish school. These schools started out very small, with very few students and very few teachers. It took a long time for these schools to develop the way that they developed. What's interesting about Maimonides at this point is not so much the success of Maimonides. I think it's much more the idea of Maimonides. And that is that there was a tremendous amount of opposition within the Boston Jewish community to the founding of Maimonides. It's kind of amusing, in a sense, to think about that today. You imagine Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik started a school. You'd think, oh my God, Joseph Soloveitchik started a school, so automatically it's obviously going to be something that everybody would accept. It didn't work that way. First of all, Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 1930s and 1940s was not the Rabbi Soloveitchik of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. That's important. And the second thing is that this was about something much bigger than Rabbi Soloveitchik. This was about their attitude towards America. And they considered the Maimonides Day School to be a return to the ghetto. They believed that the American Jewish immigrant needed to send their children to public school. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, absolutely not. But he didn't say absolutely not because he wanted them to go to a cheder. He believed that Maimonides, that a school that taught secular studies and taught Jewish studies was not a compromise, but it actually was very much American. Now, I have to say that just a couple of points here before we move on. Number one, another important point about Rabbi Soloveitchik is, talking about Rabbi Soloveitchik's influence in Boston, that Rabbi Soloveitchik's influence in Boston was actually not the same as Rabbi Soloveitchik's influence within the Yeshiva University community. Once Rabbi Soloveitchik became entrenched in the Yeshiva University community, his view was really the accepted view, largely, in Yeshiva University. In Boston, it wasn't like that, because in Boston, there were many rabbis, and actually, they didn't like Rabbi Soloveitchik, because Rabbi Soloveitchik, and I know you're not going to be surprised to hear this, Rabbi Soloveitchik was not a consensus kind of rabbi. He wasn't someone who called rabbinic meetings to find out what everybody thought and then to make decisions based on the consensus. He didn't ask other people's opinion. Do you think I should start Maimonides? Do you think public school is better? Rabbi Soloveitchik was Rabbi Soloveitchik. If he decided that there needed to be a Maimonides, there needed to be a Maimonides. You very well understand that other rabbis in Boston didn't want him to work that way. So some of the opposition, and this is always tricky, you know, when you try to understand the historical event, you know, it's always tricky to understand how much is ideological and how much is personal, right? How much was it that, you know, they believe the kids should go to public school and therefore they didn't like Maimonides Day School because it was American to go to public school? And how much was it they just didn't like Rabbi Soloveitchik? That's not the way we do things in Boston. And because this is not the way we do things in Boston, therefore we're going to send our kids to public school. We're not going to send our kids to Maimonides. Again, you can't know the answer. This is one of those historical moments that you can't know. All you know is that there are a couple of different balls up in the air. There are a couple of different factors that needed to be considered. There's something else that you need to remember. And that is, you need to think about what the place of orthodoxy, or what the meaning of orthodoxy was in America in the 1930s. You know, we talked about the fact that this was the first generation in which there were more American-born Jews than European-born Jews. As that happened, as the generation of European-born Jews gave birth to a generation of American-born Jews, so there was, in a sense, a crisis for Orthodoxy. Think about it. These American-born Jews go to public school. They become very much Americanized. They go to university, generally City College in New York in those days, and then they get jobs. Until 1935, there was a six-day work week in America. We all know the story. If you don't come to work on Saturday, then you'll be looking for a new job on Monday. So for many of these Orthodox, actually, they were what we would call non-observant Orthodox. The shul that they went to was an Orthodox shul. They wouldn't have considered going to a Reform or, as it developed, a conservative shul. They were Orthodox, largely because of loyalty to their parents, but they were Orthodox. But on Shabbos, they went to work. That's just what everybody did. Just as a kind of parenthetical note, I'll note that Rabbi Herbert S. Goldstein, who was the rabbi of the Institutional Synagogue in Harlem, he, in the 1920s, recognized that so many of his members were going to work on Shabbos morning, that he moved the main service, the Orthodox shul, he moved the main service from Shabbos morning to Friday night. On Friday night, he would give his big drasha, his big sermon. There would be a big oneg, which we would call today a big kiddush, after the davening on Friday night. Because he said, listen, you know, I could get up in shul on Shabbos and scream and yell that everybody's going to work on Shabbos. There's only one problem. There'd be nobody to hear me give the speech because they're all in work on Shabbos morning. So I do better giving my speech on Friday night when they all actually come to shul. Now, whether or not that pivot, whether or not that strategy is a good strategy or not, is for a Rabbi, is Rabbi Kelman, is for a different conversation. That's a fascinating question about how to deal with the non-observant Orthodox. But when you understand Rabbi Soloveitchik and the fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik was trying to save Orthodoxy, you have to understand what it means that Rabbi Soloveitchik was saving Orthodoxy. Rabbi Soloveitchik in the 1930s and 1940s was dealing with an Orthodoxy that identified as Orthodox, but was not really observing Orthodoxy in a way that Rabbi Soloveitchik thought that Orthodoxy should be observed. And Rabbi Soloveitchik understood that the next generation, the children, if he was going to save Orthodoxy, Rabbi Soloveitchik was going to have to save Orthodoxy through the next generation. The parents, the fathers were going to work on Shabbos. He couldn't, maybe he addressed that, but he wasn't going to solve that problem. But he was going to save Orthodoxy with the next generation. So the founding of the Maimonides school was really Rabbi Soloveitchik's attempt to save Orthodoxy. Rabbi Soloveitchik decided that the public schools and Chadarim after the public schools was not going to save Orthodoxy. In a sense, that was the decision of Rabbi Joseph H. Lookstein when he began the Ramaz school. That was the decision of the founders of the of Flatbush when they began Flatbush. The truth of the matter is that was really the decision of those who founded the schools in Borough Park, Eitz Chaim and Shulamith, which were separate schools. We would say today a little frummer, whatever that term means, right? That term meant something different in 1935 than it does in 2020. But whatever it means, that was what they believed. They believed that they were going to save Orthodoxy. But specifically in the 1930s, the saving of Orthodoxy was because they were witnessing a generation of non-observant Orthodox Jews. And that group needed to be saved. And that's the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik decided to save it. Now, what I want to spend the rest of my time today talking about is two things that today we kind of take for granted in some schools and we consider to be anathema in other schools. And that is coeducation and the teaching of Gemara to girls. Now, in the 1930s, there were different kinds of schools. Torah Vadas was only a boys' school. Eitz Chaim was only a boys' school. Shulamith was only a girls' school. Chaim Berlin was only a boys' school. Ramaz and Flatbush were obviously coeducational. They were for boys and girls. Rabbi Soloveitchik had his school, forget what he believed for a second, his school was both coeducational, means boys and girls together, and they taught girls Gemara. Everything was together. The classes were together. The education was together. There was no difference between boys and girls. What's interesting, and in a sense surprising, though we'll come back to it, is that Rabbi Soloveitchik leaves absolutely no written record about this topic. He does not discuss anywhere why he made Maimonides coeducational or why he taught girls Gemara in Maimonides. Now that comment is probably the most interesting comment of the whole discussion. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about everything, right? I mean, he writes articles and books and everything. What Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, he wrote. But he doesn't write about this. Now the fact that he didn't write about this topic has led people to give other kinds of explanations. Rabbi Herschel Schechter tried to explain, that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't really want to teach girls Gemara. He didn't really want coeducation. But Maimonides in the early years was so small, and it was so hard for him to attract students to Maimonides, that he had no choice but to make the class coeducational and to teach girls Gemara. That was Rabbi Schechter's view on this topic. By the way, I see Phyllis Tobin here. I apologize. Elizabeth, Rabbi Teitz, was extremely, extremely important in terms of founding the schools in Elizabeth. And that it, Rabbi Teitz requires his own lecture, and it's an own fascinating discussion. I kind of focused on Ramaz and Ramaz and Fat, but Rabbi Teitz was a very important figure during this period as well. There are some, there were some suggestions, you know. Seth Farber in his book has a story of one teacher who claimed that Rabbi Soloveitchik told him to sit the boys and the girls separately in class in Maimonides. You know, you have these kinds of stories. He also has this great thing, Seth Farber, in his book, in which he has a teacher evaluation form. And it seems that they evaluated the teacher about whether or not the teacher brought up the topic of teaching girls Gemara in class, meaning that wasn't a topic in the 1940s and 1950s that was supposed to be brought up in class. Now, what you see from this is a couple of things. And this is really the point I want to make. You know, first of all, the fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik did not write on this topic allows everybody to interpret his actions however they want to interpret his actions. And obviously, each one of these interpretations is not a reflection about why Rabbi Soloveitchik made the classes coeducational or made the class or taught girls Gemara. It's a reflection of the person who gives the opinion, right? Because we don't know exactly why he did it. So it tells you something. Rabbi Schechter thought this way, and this Rebbe thought this way, and these two teachers thought this way. Rabbi Wurzberger is quoted as saying it was a great innovation to teach girls Gemara. They're really talking about what their approach was to the teaching to girls learning Gemara. I think that point is very interesting. And obviously, all of these interpretations are given decades later and don't necessarily reflect the way Rabbi Soloveitchik was thinking in the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s. And I think that point is probably the most important point of all. Just by 1 minute of background, we know that the history of Jewish girls' education is a complicated one. We generally give credit to Sarah Schneer for starting the Beis Yaakov movement in 1917, but we know that Rabbi Sanson Rachel Hirsch was very much involved in the education of Jewish girls, and there were others before Sarah Schneer. But what we see, at least if we take Sarah Schneer's example from 1917, and she had a haskama first from the Belzer Rebbe and then from the Chafetz Chaim, is that Sarah Schneer went to the Belzer Rebbe and said that the girls in Poland, the Jewish girls in Poland, are leaving Orthodoxy. And if we don't start a school immediately, we're going to lose these girls to traditional Judaism. And the Belzer Rebbe gave a bracha, of course, that you should have a Jewish school. And the Beis Yaakov movement, which interestingly enough started as an afternoon school only later, just before the war, became all-day schools. And basically that saved this entire generation of young Jewish girls. It saved them to Orthodoxy. And therefore, to talk about what Rabbi Soloveitchik's view was about teaching girls Gemara in the 1930s, the 40s, the 50s, to me, the only thing that's interesting is the fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't write about it. You know, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to write to the parents in Maimonides. Seth Farber collects a tremendous amount of fascinating material about what Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, the letters that he used to write to the parent body. Believe me, if teaching girls Gemara was an issue, Rabbi Soloveitchik had the courage and the know-how to write a letter. The fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik didn't write a letter to me means that it literally wasn't an issue. It wasn't anything to discuss. Now, what Rabbi Soloveitchik thought in his mind, whether Rabbi Soloveitchik would have preferred to have chadarim or whatever they had in Lithuania, and whether, you know, he thought the girls should be educated or not educated the way they were in Lithuania, is totally and completely irrelevant. What what Rabbi Soloveitchik understood in Boston, and this is a fascinating bigger topic, the difference between Rabbi Soloveitchik in Boston and Rabbi Soloveitchik in New York. But what Rabbi Soloveitchik understood in Boston was that the Orthodox community, that orthodoxy in Boston, required a school like Maimonides, that the future of orthodoxy required a school like Maimonides. And that, what do you mean? Girls aren't going to learn Gemara. We're going to have a separate school for boys and girls. That was ridiculous. This was orthodoxy in the 1930s and the 1940s in Boston. They needed a school for Orthodox children. They needed a school that would keep people, boys and girls, young men and young women, committed to Judaism. This isn't something Rabbi Soloveitchik needed to prove in any way. As things became more complicated, and again, as we, you know, we become more privileged, and that, you know, we're able to create different kinds of schools with different kinds of flavors, like Haagen-Dazs, we can have every single flavor of Haagen-Dazs in terms of our Jewish day schools. So we have the privilege of saying we can teach girls Gemara, we can teach them Torah Shabbat Peh, we can teach them Torah Shabbat Peh twice a week, or four times a week, or six times a week. We can do whatever we want, but we have to understand. I mean, I'm just saying the obvious now. We have to understand that we're living a Jewish education world of privilege. Rabbi Soloveitchik was not living that world of privilege. For Rabbi Soloveitchik, this was the ideal. And the reason this was the ideal was the sense that this is what was necessary in Boston. What would have been true somewhere else or in some other place was totally and completely irrelevant to Rabbi Soloveitchik. That was not at all what Rabbi Soloveitchik was interested in. And to me, and I'll get to the questions, I ignored the questions, but I'm going to take the questions in a second. To me, this, well, let me first say, the story of the founding of Maimonides is just one piece in the beginning of Jewish day school education in America. I said, you know, I said to Phyllis a second ago, you know, there's a lecture and, you know, and a semester and a year's worth of courses on Rabbi Teitz and the beginning of Elizabeth and how Rabbi Teitz was such an amazing pioneer in Elizabeth. Obviously, there's a semester on by Joseph Lookstein, and obviously there's a semester on the Yeshiva Flatbush, and, you know, you can mention all the other, you know, the other schools and all the other places and all the other communities. So number one is I use Maimonides only as an example, just to tell you a story. The story could be told in a slightly different fashion for these other schools. In a way, the story of Maimonides is interesting because Rabbi Soloveitchik became, and here's the key word, he became such an influential character, influential leader and rabbi in American modern Orthodoxy. So understanding Rabbi Soloveitchik's role in these early days in Boston is interesting. But again, a lot of it had to do with the fact that the Rabbi Soloveitchik of Boston in the 30s and 40s was very much different than the Rabbi Soloveitchik of the, you know, of the later decades. But what we understand is that all the schools that we send our children or grandchildren to, or that we teach in, or that we know about, in a sense, we're all on the shoulders of the courageous leaders who took a stand to begin these schools. Whether it was Rabbi Soloveitchik who had to stand up to the Boston community who thought that it was un-American to start the schools, whether it was those who questioned women learning Gemara, girls learning Gemara, there were a lot of issues. And these people had the courage, and maybe basically, Rabbi Silverberg, the fact that it cost $400 a year was a huge deal, right? And who was willing to spend $400 a year on a school? That was crazy to spend $400 a year on a school. But they had tremendous courage. They understood that the future of American Orthodoxy depended on these schools. And they built these schools. And our system that we have now is really on the shoulders of these giants, of these courageous giants. Now, let me just, rather than talk more, let me just go back to the beginning. So, you can wait to the other. Okay. So, did the Rav or his strong supporters go to the Jewish community at large federations for funding? That's a funny question. The answer is no. We wasn't an organized community in those days. Rabbi Soloveitchik had a few people in Boston who supported his school, and he basically, those are the people who paid for the school. That's a funny question, but it's a good question. People have possibly written in the Rav's Torah. The Rav himself published little during his lifetime. It's actually, that's true, but the Rav did write articles, many articles, and the Rav did write letters to the community of Maimonides, including about Rabbi Soloveitchik's wife not wearing a shaitel, arguments of Sire, difficult to do, speculative. Okay, that's fine. Also, by the way, I didn't get involved in that. Rebbetzin Soloveitchik was very much involved in Maimonides, and Seth Farber has a discussion about what Rebbetzin Soloveitchik's role was in Boston, was in Maimonides, was also interesting. Dr. Naomi Seidman, fascinating series on the founding of Beis Yaakov this Wednesday. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Until about 50 years ago, the combined Jewish philanthropies of Boston did not support in any meaningful way Jewish education like Maimonides. The CJP was more into raising money for hospitals like Beit Israel. Okay, fine. I vaguely recall Rabbi Natty Helfgott including a letter of the Rav in his book saying that he felt teaching co-ed was a lechatchila, not a b'dieved. That's very interesting. Is that Michael? If you could send me that article, or at least tell me where in Natty's book that is, I'd very much appreciate that. I didn't know. I at least had forgotten that article. There was a letter from Israel H, 1953, to the Flatbush leadership to consider teaching Gemara to women as a given. Oh, that's also interesting. Fascinating. It gives insight into our own day school education. Thank you. Okay. I appreciate that. So if those letters do exist, and I trust you that those letters exist, that would be interesting. But that would just be, kind of the end of the discussion. So all of the kind of reinterpretations of later generations as to why Rabbi Soloveitchik taught girls Gemara, if Rabbi Soloveitchik actually wrote those letters saying it was a lechatchila, that would make it even more interesting. So I hope that today we learned a little bit about the Orthodox community in Boston, a little bit about Rabbi Soloveitchik in Boston, a little bit about, co-education and teaching girls Gemara, Nikki Katz. The Rav told me that what the boys needed was a good woman's education. I will teach them Gemara. That's a fantastic story. Okay, that's the end of the discussion. That's all we need to say. Very good. Thank you so much. So there's a lot of fascinating stuff. Next week, what I want to do is I want to take a snapshot. Yeshiva University, 1971. Have a good week, everybody. Shavua Tov.
Yes. Rabbi, before you go, I pulled out of Natty's book.
Oh, yeah.
81 is the letter, a Talmud Torah for girls in Yeshiva High School. This is fascinating what he writes. I read this, well, I also haven't seen it for years. I stress, unless I am assured in advance by the school administration that my recommendation will be followed, I would not take the trouble to investigate the matter. Since such an official assurance has been withheld, I must decline to consider the problem. The reason for my reluctance to engage in this controversial issue is the unique stand taken by many of our Jews on matters of law and tradition. We have reached a stage in which party lines and political ideologies influence our halakhic thinking to the extent that people cannot rise above partisan issues to the level of halakhic objectivity. It's a short letter, but basically he refused to answer the question unless they were going to listen. So that's in the
place. I mean, I don't know what you learned from that letter. Do you learn from that letter that he was, so what was his position based on that letter?
I don't know, but the fact that he taught at Stern, of course, in the 70s, he gave the first...
So I want to tell you something. This is the last point, and then I'll let everybody go. The fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik taught the Gemara class in Stern in 1977, you have to understand that the world, the difference between 1937 and 1977 was a different planet. Now, that was an important moment, and some people talked about this as they remembered Rabbi Lamb, that was a very important moment. But 1937 is different than 1977. I would just say, Rabbi Kelman, from the letter you read me, that is not exactly a strong statement, right?
I agree. I just find the letter is a fascinating letter. But... Okay. Anyway.
Okay. And the person who just asked me if I'm related to Rabbi Mintz from Baltimore, the answer is yes. Have a good week, everybody. Shavua Tov. See you next week. Be well, everybody. Regards.